Would you pray with me? God, give us enough light and will to say just what we see what we do what we say what you will. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen. Good morning, everyone. I have to tell you right off the bat that lately I've found myself thinking a fair bit about fear. And there are a few reasons for that. One is that a couple weeks ago, I got my second dose right here. And I have to tell you, I felt something change bodily, right? And I don't mean that I could actually feel my body producing these new antibodies in my bloodstream. And I'm not even talking about the flu-like side effects that basically wiped me out and made me rather pathetic for about a day and a half. I mean, a kind of like palpable loosening and lightening. I was listening to this interview with a biopsychologist named Mary Poppenroth, and she describes our body's stress response this way that I think will sound familiar to you. Neck and lower back tighten, breath shortens, heart quickens. And why? Because our bodies are getting ready to get out or to fight it out, right? And our bodies ramp up like this automatically without us telling them to. And they do it in two kinds of scenarios, she said. One, when we are in obvious and immediate physical danger, right? A reckless driver beside you swerves, whether you're in a car or on a bike or on the crosswalk, or you hear a gunshot nearby, much too nearby. But our bodies also ramp up like this when the danger is more nebulous, open to interpretation. And storytelling animals that you and I are, our stress response is equally triggered by the stories we tell to make sense of potential threats in any given moment, or to interpret a moment that might have a threat lurking around the corner under the bed. And Poppenroth says that those kinds of stress responses all boil down to two basic worries. She calls them fictional. She means it in the sense of the stories that we tell. One worry is, I don't think I am or have enough. And the other is, I'm not sure I'm in control. And when you think about those, I'm not sure I am or have enough, I'm not sure I'm in control, then surely we can recognize together that these months of pandemic have had a way of flicking the switch of our body's stress response, right? Like the teenager who forgets to turn the light off again. Apologies to my father. Or the annoying younger brother who grabs the switch and toggles it on and off to strobe the light. That's apologies to my sister, I think. And all of that, I think, helps explain why it is that in some way my body seemed to loosen and to lighten up a little bit after my second dose, because the vaccine was giving me enough elbow room, just enough room to renegotiate my relationship to fear. Fear, I said. But I had just been saying the word stress response, right? Well, here's the thing. Poppenroth says stress is just another word for fear. And that one of the quirks of Western, relatively affluent people like me, and likely like you, is that we love to use the word stress. We will even wear it as a badge in good times, but we will avoid the word fear at all costs. We edit fear out. And sometimes we do this literally. Sometimes we do it in our lectionaries, which is done today in this remarkable story from 2 Samuel about David dancing the ark to Jerusalem. And you wouldn't know it unless you were paying attention to the verses, but we chop about 6 verses out. We chop out the part where in between these movements of the dance, David becomes deathly afraid. And it changes the story to take the fear out of it. But we'll come back to that. Because here's the thing. Fear is an unavoidable part of being human. And for us, gathered on a Sunday like this, fear actually has everything to do with living coram Deo, before the face of God. And you can open up almost at random in the Bible, and you will find reasons to remember that, right? I mean, in the Bible, every freaking angel plus Jesus pulls out the exact same line in moments of spiritual encounter. Do not be afraid. As if like it's part of like the boilerplate, like divine cue card that they have to say this first before they can say anything else. But equally, just as the Bible has all of these messengers insist, do not be afraid, do not be afraid, do not be afraid. The Bible heartily commends to us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And even Jesus, we're not just talking about some Old Testament God here, so to speak. Even Jesus on occasion tries to scare the hell out of us. Anyone who causes one of these little children to stumble, he says, would be better off having a millstone fastened around their neck and thrown overboard. He means it. And if that doesn't scare you, if that doesn't scare you in light of the news of the last month, as an Anglican, then we're not paying attention. We don't get to get around fear. Our only choice is what we do with it. So today, I think, when maybe a bunch of us, I hope you're feeling a little lighter and looser than you have in a while. Today, the scriptures are giving us a little bit of elbow room to face fear together and to ask some questions. Because here's the deal. I think that we encounter today a tale of two kings, which ultimately comes down to a tale of two kinds of fear, but in a surprising way, in two very different ways of responding to it. We've got us Herod in the time of Jesus, and we've got David among the ancestors of Jesus. So let's take them one at a time. First, Herod. This is one of the most peculiar stories in all of the Gospels. And here's why, straight off the bat. Because it's one of the only stories you'll find in the Gospels where Jesus has a bit part. He's mentioned as the inciting incident and then left to the side. What's the deal? Jesus is doing his healing, teaching, rallying thing that we know him for. Herod hears about it. Some of it sounds an awful lot like someone that occupies a raw nerve in Herod's conscience. John the Baptist. Why does Jesus prick Herod's conscience? Well, Mark will shift into flashback to tell us, because by this time that Jesus is doing this, John is dead and gone, and that was Herod's doing. So when Herod worries, is this John back from the dead? We are witnessing Herod having the specters of his own conscience and his own misdeeds coming back to haunt him. And as you listen to this story played out, a story which deserves so much more time than we'd have on a morning like this, the thing that you will see is that Herod at every juncture is utterly controlled by the calculus of fear. What's he scared of? Well, to begin with, that John's words are somehow going to sully the public relations campaign around his marriage plans. that John would exacerbate the question mark that lies over Herod's legitimacy as a king in Israel, a legitimacy that he's worked so hard to buttress, not least by taking up a pretty ambitious project of renovation and beautifying at the Jerusalem temple. John's words could get in the way of that. Then why not get rid of John, especially when your wife says, I want him out of here? Well, he's scared of John too. And he's scared of John's reputation with the people. And he also wants to be on the people's good side. And so Herod's in a bind. So the compromise is that John ends up in prison until this fateful night. He's throwing a birthday party. He's got all the nobles, all the people he wants to keep close and on side. He's feeding them, watering them. And this woman comes out and dances, Herodias's daughter. And before Herod knows it, having made a show of his largesse, he's in the position of having given a blank check. And he's been asked for the head of John the Baptist. And given what we know, this is not a request Herod is excited to fulfill. But he does anyways. And why? Because he's scared of failing to come through when all of these people have their eyes trained on him. If he left this party humiliated, what would become of his power, which is always threatening to fall out of his hands like water through cupped fingers? Now, what's interesting about this is that these are precisely the kinds of fictional fears that Mary Poppenroth talks about. The fear of not being enough. The fear of not having control. Herod is in no immediate physical mortal danger. Most of the fears that visit us aren't that kind of fear, after all. They are the kinds of fears that Herod is tangling with here. And the other thing that's interesting is trying to look for God and God's place in Herod's calculus. Is the God of Israel goes unmentioned. The God of Israel is edited out. But you can catch glimpses of what Herod's relation to this God might be between the lines. If this God occupies any space in Herod's imagination, it's as a threat. Someone who would put Herod's decisions under question through the mouth of a prophet. Someone who would call into question the way of a life that Herod has tried to build, which in the end comes down to pursuing the goal of trying not to lose too much while you try to accumulate enough and save it for yourself as long as you can. And the picture we get of this king of Israel is of someone who is thoroughly unfree. Bound up, who does not make decisions because his own fears make decisions for him. And when the daughter of Herodias dances, Herod plays it safe by playing fast and loose with the life of another, because he can't risk himself unraveling. Think of that then, right next to the story of David that Anne read for us. The backstory here, of course, is that you've got this thing called the Ark, which is a Hebrew word that means a box. It is a box on some poles with a couple angel statues on top. And what is this thing? It is the throne of the God of Israel that they carried through the wilderness. This belongs in the tent temple, which is the tabernacle. And the Philistines local people that had been Israel's constant enemies in these days had confiscated it. Israel had gotten it back, and it was sort of left in limbo. And so David and everyone go to get the thing, to bring it to the capital, to Jerusalem, to the place where it's not going to even end up eventually in a tent, but in a temple. And the whole thing begins and ends in dance and tambourines, and we heard it, cymbals. Lots of drummers around, apparently. In the middle, though, our lectionary takes out several verses. And when I read them to you, as I'm about to, I think you'll know why. But we should not leave them out. So when this dancing troupe came to a certain threshing floor, the oxen who were leading the way and in part carrying the ark, stumbled, and Uzzah reached out and held the ark of God. And the Lord was angry with Uzzah and struck him down for his imprudent action, and he died there beside the ark of God. David was vexed because the Lord's anger had broken out on Uzzah, and he called the place Perez Uzzah, the name it still bears. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How can the ark of God come to me?" He felt he could not take the ark of the Lord with him to the city of David. He turned aside and carried it to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. And the ark of the Lord remained at Obed-Edom's house for 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and his whole household. And then we pick up the story with the lectionary. 3 months. Uzzah reaches out to steady the ark, a seemingly innocuous gesture, and Uzzah is snuffed out. The text says that the Lord is angry. The text does not say why. And we are in the same position as David. What has just happened? Surely the Lord was on our side. Surely we're doing a good thing. How could this happen? And the whole thing remains unsettling. Centuries later, you can comb through the history of Jewish and Christian interpretation. You will not find a satisfying answer for why this happened. We are in the same position as David was. So what does David do? He leaves the thing for 3 months. He abandons his plan. He is scared. Then he comes back. And what's so interesting to me is what David does next. So we're not told what David's thinking. David has seen blessing come on the household where the ark has rested. But David has no guarantee that the same wouldn't happen again or worse. David is under no illusions that he's dealing with some domesticated deity whose wildness might not break out. This God is a wildfire. And so you might think that David and the crew, if they tried to take the ark to Jerusalem, would put together a much more solemn procession. And that's not what happens at all. They abandon all pretense of safety even further. Every 6 steps, it says, they sacrifice a bull or an oxen or a bison. And David throws himself back into the dance. He becomes Herodias's daughter. He's the erotic, provocative dancer, dressed like an Anglican subdeacon, except whirling and jumping as if it's the last night of a Pentecostal revival tent meeting. And everyone thinks he looks like an idiot, most of all his wife, Michal. And David does not give a rip. David throws himself into the dance. in the face of the fear of death. And what place does God play in this story? Well, a very different one. Because God, not the people of Herod, but God is the source of the uncertainty. He is the wild card that throws off the calculus of all David's decision making and all David's efforts at control and at being satisfied with himself and being enough and even having his own skin protected. But David chooses not to leave the ark for someone else to deal with. This ark, which is the promise of God's personal, wild, untamed presence with his people. David chooses not to be in control or to appear before the people as if he has all of this in control. And David does not worry about saving face. Because maybe you can't avoid loss and threat and the surprise of death. Not in a world like the one that we live in with David. And not with a God like this. So David, like someone who's falling in love, but who's been hurt so many times that he has reason to guard all the angles or hedge every bet or introduce layers of separation, does the opposite and he goes for broke, puts himself on the line, takes the path of joy and excess and praise and devotion and risks. For all he knows, there is immediate bodily danger, as well as the fear of not being enough and of having no control. But when desire, love, and fear meet in David, the chemical reaction is a kind of what the hell faith. A faith that dances on the edge of danger. A faith that chooses to give up the illusion that we should or could play it safe. In this world, and with this God. So a second century Christian writer named Irenaeus, who said this line, you've probably heard someone quote it somewhere along the way. Irenaeus said, the glory of God is a human being fully alive. The glory of God is a human being fully alive. Now, which of these two kings do we see fully alive? It's not Herod. Herod is living a half-life of unfreedom, trying to ward off his fears as best he can, while David is set free and wild in the face of legitimate fear. And this is important because we might be at a spot, my friends, God make it so, where this, we have good reasons to be lighter and looser than we've been in a while. But we are not out of the reach of fear. Even if this pandemic is in full-on recession and will be a memory in a year or two, there will always be new fears in a world like this and with a God like this. Will we seek the glory of being people who are fully alive? It's when Jesus said, the one who tries to save his life will lose it, but the one who loses his life for my sake will keep it for good. He might have just been talking about Herod on the one hand and David on the other. And that's probably why Jesus himself danced into Jerusalem, knowing full well that God's wildness would not spare him the touch of death. But like David, picking up the dance again, Jesus's wild embrace of the joyous glorious task of being human before this wild God in a world such as this ends with him looking us in the face, every man, woman, child, and person, and freely giving bread, food. The kind of freedom through fear that leads to generosity. The glory of a human being fully alive.